Welcome to Bald Move TV, the officially unofficial podcast for all of television. But just between us, we're covering a movie today. I'm your host, Cecily.
I'm your co-host, Alexis.
Alexis.
You don't know me. Hi. Hello.
Alexis, you might already know from as the lead designer, CEO, and girl boss of Pin-Y.
All these things are true. Yes. Yep.
So what we're doing today is we are making an announcement. We're going to be covering together His Dark Materials on HBO, which is going to be in this Bald Move television podcast. Each of those episodes are going to air on HBO starting Monday, November 4th, and our coverage of the show will be on this podcast the Wednesday after it airs. So what we're doing today is just covering the 2007 movie The Golden Compass to get everyone's beaks wet. We'll be getting into some light book spoilers throughout the course of this. Maybe nothing that spoils anything outside of the first book, do you think?
And maybe nothing that spoils outside of the first movie, I would say.
Yeah, that too.
There's some shenanigans there.
Yeah, so if you are afraid of getting spoiled for anything outside of that, then you've got everything you need. We'll see you in November. if you're sticking with us, it's going to be a good one. So let's get started.
Sounds good. Let's do it.
This movie, I will say up front, does a lot of heavy lifting in just explaining and expositing everything that's happening.
In their defense, it is kind of an enormous world to just walk into because the rules are very different from what we're used to.
I would love to see like a behind the scenes of how this got made, because obviously they had an amazing cast to work with. The script just seems like writing it had to have been a slog, because it felt like some scenes felt like that too. But I found myself at the end of it, even though there were some concerns along the way, I found myself desperately wanting more movies from this cast and world. It's beautiful. Some of the designs of like the vehicles and the things.
The city.
Yeah, the cities.
Really beautiful. Yeah.
Incredible.
It's kind of that like retro futuristic, almost steampunk.
Yeah.
But not quite. Yeah.
Like it gets into the steampunk when we see Lee Scoresby's ship and maybe like Miss Coulter's matching carriage to her airship blimp. Thing. Right. So cool.
This is the movie that broke New Line Cinema.
What? Really?
Yeah.
You have insider information.
I have insider information.
Give it to us.
Okay, so here's what happened. This movie was a huge, very ambitious undertaking. They spent $180 million. Yeah, that was the budget for this movie. The original director quit. Someone else signed on.
Like, they started filming and he quit? Or she?
They hadn't even done anything with it yet. They were still in the script phase.
Okay.
And he quit because he was like, who am I, Peter Jackson? Like, he actually said that. And he quit and they hired somebody else. That dude looked at the script and said, nah. So then the original guy came back. He was the first and third director of this movie.
Okay, it's a wonder it turned out as well as it did then.
Yeah, the script was rewritten multiple times. There were three original scripts, and they picked the best of the three, I guess, apparently.
Okay.
Uh-huh. News to me. So they made this movie, and I don't know if it was because of the religious controversy or it might have been mostly that. I don't know.
In 2007, that seems likely.
Yeah, it was supposed to be a family film, but there was all this controversy, and that can kill family films.
Yeah.
So it came in at $70 million in the box office.
Oh.
Yeah.
Yikes.
And to recoup costs, New Line Cinema sold the overseas rights. So then, when the overseas money came in, which was $280 million, New Line didn't get any of that money. They completely screwed the pooch on the whole project.
Oh, yeah.
So that is when they got restructured, which is to say Warner Brothers had to swoop in, and now they supervise all of New Line's projects.
Interesting.
They have to run their budget by them, and the number of movies they're able to produce each year was cut in half.
Hmm.
So you could say that Warner Brothers was the Miss Coulter to New Line's Lyra.
Yeah, did they incise New Line away from their demon that is the Golden Compass?
Yeah, I saw one thing say that this movie, it's like they killed the soul of the Golden Compass and took the body.
Yes.
Which I would say is fairly accurate. There are masterful attempts to save this movie by the actors mm-hmm. and some of the writing, but it is ultimately, I think, a little bit of a kind of a hollow shell of what it could have been.
Yeah. Yeah. There are some places where you can see that they scrimped a bit, like in the editing department.
Mm-hmm.
The kind of like book comparison stuff, I want to save till the end for anyone who mm-hmm. doesn't want to hear too much of that. And they just want to hear us talk about 2007's Golden Compass because we got things to say.
Oh, we do.
Before we get any further, I got to do some housekeeping for Bald Move. And there is so much house to keep, I'm going to have to do it like Micro Machines, commercial guy fashion. Watchmen has come. It's finally here. The follow-up to Damon Lindelof's The Leftovers. And it gets a full treatment, instant live cast for club members, as well as an instant talk, just like we did for Westworld and Game of Thrones. And a full cast with recap analysis and feedback on Tuesdays. We're also still doing Rick and Morty. We're at Season 3, Tales from the Citadel. We have an amazing guest, Gustavo Cerola from Rooster Teeth, to break down all of our hip evil Morty theories. Cecily and I are still doing American Horror Stories Season 9, 1984. If you want to get some October spook on, it's safe to jump in at this season because it's anthology. None of the previous seasons mattered. Also, Cecily and I are doing the Cinema Spooktacular, our third annual installment to Search for Spook. Volume 2 just came out over the weekend, talking about Tallgrass, Sleepaway Camp, and Crawl. Jim and I are covering the final season of Mr. Robot with episodes released on Wednesdays. Check it out on the 2-Bit Encryption feed. And that's all the housing that got kept.
So, the opening narration by Eva Green explains a lot. That there are parallel universes and worlds, and in her world, which is the one we're inhabiting in the movie, your demon walks alongside you and is your soul. Connecting everything is dust, and that there were these alethiometers, which are also the Golden Compass, that can tell the truth, and that the Magisterium, which is the ruling power overall, destroyed all of these alethiometer devices and has forbidden the talk of dust. So right away I'm confused because within the first like time we meet Lord Asriel, he's trying to argue that there are parallel universes and worlds.
Mm-hmm.
And the opening dialogue of a witch, who we know is a witch later and probably already knows that this is true, is telling us that these things are true.
Right.
And we're introduced to dust and the alethiometers and everything. So we start with our cast at Jordan College.
Mm-hmm.
Which I do. Okay, this is something I got from the books. Is a prestigious college, but one of a lot of colleges in this area.
In the city, even.
Yeah.
So, I believe, I think the parallel to like our universe
mm-hmm.
is Oxford College.
Okay.
Because it's the city is Oxford.
Okay.
And it's Jordan College within Oxford.
Gotcha.
That's so interesting.
Yeah, there's a lot of places that are like Earth-esque,
mm-hmm.
but slightly different throughout here.
Right.
We meet Lyra playing with a bunch of Egyptian children and other, what do you call, kids who are probably working, but not exactly servants and housekeepers, but they're the children who are servants and housekeepers.
Yeah, the kids of servants, kind of like just like loose city children.
Yeah.
Basically,
we get
we
get that Lyra is not one of many scholars' children. She's just a child here playing with the children of everyone around that mm-hmm. she can find that's her peer.
I actually thought it was interesting. I don't know if it's just because they managed to get Daniel Craig as mm-hmm. Asriel, but he is introduced before Lyra is.
Yeah,
which is so crazy. He plays not an insignificant part in the overall plot mm-hmm. of the series, but he is not actually involved in the books very much.
Right.
But yeah, we see him first.
When we see him a lot.
We see him a lot in this movie, yeah.
For someone who we never hear like speak or really know what he's doing.
Yeah.
So more exposition here in this scene. We meet the kids. We see that we learn that Lyra is a really gifted storyteller and someone who can make things up and really spin a yarn. And that this very friendly bully. I know how kids are.
Yeah.
But they're having fun. They're playing war. But he also in the scene reminds her that she's just an orphan that was left at the college. That's just something you throw away at each other's faces. But also kind of in this scene, we see Lyra and Pantalaimon are walking and, we get his name and he quickly changes shapes. And in this movie, he changes shapes. He's got a couple of favored shapes.
Mm-hmm.
And we know that they don't settle into any shape until they become an adult. But we don't know why or exactly what age.
Mm-hmm.
I had a couple of questions, which maybe we'll get into in the series or when we really dive into the books more.
Mm-hmm.
But I do know this from the books that your demon is usually the opposite sex mm-hmm. of yourself. Not always the case.
Yeah, which is very not kind to non-binary people.
Right,
but,
exactly. Yeah, there are some cases of like same sex, but I'm not sure why that's important at all. But and then Pantalaimon in the scene also explains that when either one of them is hurt, they both feel it in the same way.
Right.
And it's, as an extension of your soul also has the same feelings as you, except they're also their own entity with like thoughts and feelings.
Mm-hmm.
So anything that Lyra thinks Pantalaimon doesn't also know, they have to speak to each other. And they can also be heard by other people around them.
Mm-hmm.
Just to establish the world a little bit.
Right.
I thought that maybe at first, your demon, you could only speak to each other, which is mm-hmm. a really popular like young adult thing.
Yeah, for sure. Just having that constant companion.
Yeah.
Yeah.
So we move into inside, Pantalaimon and Lyra are exploring and they're showing what an adventurer she is. And she sees Fra Pavel and the master of the college
mm-hmm.
or a master. Fra Pavel decides to poison the wine that Azriel is going to drink. And before Azriel can drink it, Lyra bursts out of this closet and stops him from drinking it. And he uses her as a little spy in this scene.
Right. This is the opening to the first book.
Yeah.
Mm-hmm.
And she's, you can tell that he's, frustrated, but also impressed and sees. So there's a glimmer in her uncle Asriel's eye, which we'll figure out.
Yeah, he's definitely a little bit of a somewhat roguish character. You get the impression.
Yeah. And Daniel Craig. Oof.
Yeah, go on.
That's all. That's all I've got for right now. I'll save it.
Uh-huh. All right, sure.
So Lyra saves him, but is also his spy. And she overhears talk of ice bears, which is super exciting. Mm-hmm. And we see this shot of dust flowing into a man through his demon from another world. So this is one of many questions I have about dust at this point.
Mm-hmm.
This right now, this amount of dust is visible. Dust is present everywhere,
mm-hmm.
but not as condensed.
So I think they did a bad job explaining this.
Yes.
In the movie, there was a special filter that he used on his camera to get that image. It wasn't just like, you can't just see it.
Oh, well, they made it seem like you could just outright see it.
I know. It's bad. They did a bad job.
Okay. So I guess that's really not important to the end of the movie that we'll never see more of.
Right.
We also meet Asriel's demon, Stellamaria, who I love this. What is this, like a lynx type of?
I think so. I think she's a snow leopard.
Snow leopard? Yeah. Okay. Love her. Could use more of her.
She's great. Yeah.
Voiced by Kristin Scott Thomas. Everyone is voiced by someone in this movie.
Yeah, it's interesting.
This is one of those times when you appreciate having Amazon X-ray, which I'm not being paid for this, but you appreciate having this Amazon X-ray feature because I can just pause the movie and see all of the names.
Oh, is that what that is? I noticed that. I don't, spoiler alert, I don't watch as much as many things
yeah.
as the people on Bald Move do. But yeah, I noticed that feature that is super useful.
Yeah. It's just like, I can't believe, is that who I, oh, that's exactly who I think it is. Okay. No wonder they spent way too much money for such little return.
That was me with Kathy Bates later.
Yeah. So Lord Asriel says, because the college council defied the magisterium by giving him funding into this dust research, which is forbidden, that he's got to leave immediately. And he does. So a little bit later, we see Lyra on the roof with her friend Roger, and they are doing more expositing about these things that are called gobblers, which could be any kind of monster or person. That's more of a myth in these kids' mind right now.
And also, because kids are speaking about it, we don't know if that's real or not. This could just be some stupid thing that they came up with to explain why, you know, kids are moving away or something.
Right. It's in a world of magic, you just don't know.
Yeah, exactly.
Anything's possible. But so they're taking Egyptian kids, orphans, servant kids, and Roger and Lyra make a promise to save each other if anything happens at this point. Can I ask you about the word Egyptian? So this book was written in, the first book was written and published in 1995. The His Dark Materials series started then. So I guess I am confused about what Philip Pullman was going for with the Egyptian thing. I know it's, you know, I'm not calling them gypsies, but also, are they from Egypt in this world? Are they like an offshoot of people? Did Pangea break up differently? And, you know, Egypt is part of some sort of Eastern European type of...
Right.
I don't know.
When we see them on the ship, they seem to just be kind of like loosely ethnic people.
All of them, yeah.
Yeah, just a clump of loosely ethnic people, which is not great. But also,
no.
I don't know that I actually know that much about Romani culture.
No.
So that could be kind of a thing, but also just calling them Egyptians sucks, and I wish I hadn't done that.
Right. Yeah, it's got the flavor of the gypsy, the word that he wants to use,
yeah.
But not quite.
Yeah, it's got that mysticism attached to it, right?
Mm-hmm.
Yeah. That idea of mysticism.
Yeah. So anyway, they play a big part of this, and we don't get much more exposition on who they are.
Yeah, that we don't even get to see them in their usual context, which is river people. They're meant to be river people.
Right.
But they're just straight up on the ocean, doing ocean things.
And on the ice, doing ice things.
Yeah.
they also can, you know, be indigenous ice people, too, when it's necessary. I don't know.
I guess so.
Just like the Samoyeds.
Yeah, so that was, I guess maybe we can get into that a little bit later.
Yeah, let's leave that for later.
Yeah.
But I do want to make one point here. We see that this maid, Mrs. Lonsdale, brings in Lyra to clean her up. And I know from the book that she has a golden retriever as her demon.
Mm-hmm.
And you see later Miss Coulter pulls out with her airship, and you see all like the servants outside, or valets, butlers, whatever, lined up outside. And they all have dogs.
That's a thing.
And I think that's so cute.
It's weird. Also kind of sucks because they make a point. I'm going to say this like a million times, but in the books, they make a point that servants' demons usually are dogs, or the idea is that like their soul is just very servile because they happen to be servants.
Okay.
And that sucks.
That was the question I had. It's like, at what point does your demon settle into its final shape? It makes sense if it's part of your soul that you would just settle into being a servant type of person. But look, with the Samoyeds later, every single one of you identifies as a wolf.
Yeah,
there's no snow leopards out there.
Right.
There's nobody who identifies as a polar bear. Are polar bears off limits because the Panzerbjorn have already got dibs?
It's really interesting. It's very one note. Like it, I think, shows a little bit of a lack of creativity when it comes to imagining what people can be
if they choose
a certain job path.
I could render three dogs and just multiply it in post, or
But Pullman did that in the books. Like I could render with my words three dogs.
Oh, is it the same in the books?
It's basically the same. All of the Tartars have, I think they're timber wolves.
Yeah.
Timber wolf demons. Wild.
Okay, so moving on. Lyra meets Marissa Coulter at a fancy dinner with the master, and she tells Lyra that she met Lord Asriel previously at the Royal Arctic Institute. And they talk about the Svalbard ice bears, and Miss Coulter knows how to play at Lyra, just like she knows how to play at me, because anytime you talk about ice bears, I'm like, yes, I'm in.
Absolutely.
And gives her a little insight into how King Ragnar wants his own demon, which Panzer Bjorn cannot have, naturally,
mm-hmm.
and invites Lyra to go north with her. And ask the master in a very intimidating way. I think Nicole Kidman does a really interesting thing here where her eyes are just like, I'm not saying no to you because I really have no idea what you're going to do right now.
Right. They're big and sparkly and just absolutely full of deceit.
Yeah.
And craziness.
And she also, okay, in the books, it's implied that she has some sort of bewitching power that she uses to entice and bring in children,
mm-hmm.
because that's, spoiler, she's the head gobbler.
Yeah.
Then we see Mrs. Coulter's golden monkey snatching Roger and Billy.
The worst. I hate that monkey.
I think she hates the monkey.
She does.
She hates herself.
She does.
Why is she doing this on her own? You know, we see she's got a bunch of British beanie or skullcap wearing dudes that can do
the books. It wasn't like that. But in the movie, I guess it's just shorthand.
She's just doing it herself because she's an ambitious lady. Uh-huh. I'll give her that.
Yeah, she's an ambitious lady boss.
So we get a quick cut to the emissary of the Magisterium and Count Dooku.
We are suddenly thrust into a Star Wars movie, and I was like, oh shit, you got me. I'm interested again.
You spent all this money on Christopher Lee, and this is all he got in this movie.
This is all he got in this movie. Crazy. I mean, he did it great.
He did great, but I'm upset.
Yeah.
he does a great job of doing this really menacing. I mean, why not just make him the emissary of the Magisterium? Because
mm-hmm.
he is so intimidating.
Yeah, absolutely.
So he discusses how the scholars refuse to hand over the last alethiometer. They know it exists, and Asriel has the funding he needs, and the doctors at Bullvanger are close to perfecting the inoculation against the effects of dust and its corrupting influence. So again, we just get that dust is bad, but not any explanation as to what it is or why or anything.
Or why it's bad or why some people might think it's good and a thing that they need to preserve.
Yeah.
Yeah.
So I'm honestly going to save a lot of my deep dives and thoughts of what dust is and how it works for our main series podcast.
I think it's for the best because like the subtitle of this entire universe of stories could just be dust.
Yeah.
What even is it?
Yeah, right.
Is it good or bad? Yeah.
Is it? I don't know. It looks pretty.
It's very pretty.
So we see another master of the college who's expositing further that the witches told him that that Lyra is a larger part of things to come. So he gives her the alethiometer or the golden compass and lets her know that Mrs. Coulter absolutely cannot know that she has it. Mrs. Coulter can't be trusted, but trusted enough to have Lyra in her care.
Mm-hmm. Which is an interesting thing.
But also we know that Lord Asriel left the alethiometer here at the college for safekeeping.
Mm-hmm.
And also the same people who work at the college wanted to poison him.
Yeah.
So it's a lot for a young girl to consider. So they take off in a beautiful airship to London, which I want to keep calling a blimp. I think there's a better word for it, but I think those words are all indicative of it being filled with gas or air, and I think it's completely motorized right now.
Yeah, they, again, in the books, they call them airships.
Airships?
Yeah.
Okay. That's the word I was going with.
Kind of umbrella term.
I was using airship also for Lee Scoresby's ship later.
They call his a balloon, even though we will see it's like four fucking balloons strapped together.
It's so cool.
Yeah.
But what? Wild. I love the matching like Adam carriage that she has with it. We get a big, this is where the YA comes in strong. We get some Everything is Lovely montage. She's got a painting of herself and her demon, which absolutely, yes, yeah. I would too. Big decorated house. She gets to spray perfume on herself. She gets to play with a map on the wall where we see that the world is the same but different. And it's cute. It's lovely. It's something very new for Lyra. And she protests to, not in this, but she protests to wanting to be a lady a lot. And you can see that she can see in Miss Coulter a lot of similarities with herself, and that she's a refined woman, but also a scholar and very learned, and something that she could see herself doing, maybe.
Yeah, she's kind of dazzled by her and thinking like, oh, this could be like the ideal image to grow into, like a role model. Like, this could be the person that I want to be when I get older.
Right. She sees like the power she has over men sometimes. And it's.
And this is also her first brush with like money.
Yeah.
And what money can do for you.
Right.
And what money, how you can surround yourself with certain kinds of things when you have money.
Right. And it's not just things, it's people too that you buy the influence of. So Lyra gets a chance to be by herself with a compass in her room, and she sees, and she and we get to see kind of how it works, that there are three symbols that are lit up, and that there's three hands that we learn later, you can choose the symbols of, but in this scene, there's three symbols that are lit up and another hand that's just spinning like crazy.
Mm-hmm.
She doesn't know how to read it yet and doesn't really understand what's happening here. And then Mrs. Coulter comes in, and what is one of the two weirdest edits in this movie, where she comes in to say goodnight, and I think they just did it so that Nicole Kidman could have another scene of her wearing an extravagant outfit. Like, you put this on just to go to bed, girlfriend? It's insane.
Yeah.
But I love it. I love your commitment to this.
But also, how do you sleep in that? And also, how do you sleep in that and not just immediately destroy it? Or maybe that's the point.
Right.
Maybe
she's got a new one for every night.
Yeah. She just burns them when she's done with them.
Crumbles it up, throws in the fire before she goes to bed. So we get another makeover and party montage, and Pantalaimon susses out that he doesn't think they're going north. And this part makes me think, is your demon kind of like your subconscious a little bit?
Absolutely.
That's like, she was already thinking it. He's going to say it.
Yeah, exactly. And also kind of your, like, your moral golden compass. The demons also function as kind of your conscience.
Yeah.
Like, if you are doing something wrong and you know it's wrong and you feel bad about it, like, it's very possible that your demon is going to say something to you about it. And that introduces that idea that, like, yes, these are two parts of the same person, but these are also very much two separate parts.
Yeah.
You can very much, as we all know, you can fight with yourself. That's a thing.
I do it all the time.
Same. Hard same.
So Lyra mentions dust in her lessons with Miss Coulter, and that
monkey
gets her.
Not like that.
No. Monkey does not like that.
Monkey do not like.
So in this scene, she also tells her to get rid of her handbag, and she hides it in her room, but in doing so, Miss Coulter and her monkey really show Lyra that she cannot win an argument with her. She is correct in that.
She will literally just hold you down and do bad things to you.
Right. And it's gotta, I mean, there's this, it has to feel like you can still have this superiority in your own self when your demon attacks another person's demon. Like, I didn't do anything to harm you.
Mm-hmm.
That type of mentality, I feel like, is something that she uses often.
I think so. And then at this point, obviously, the shine comes off the apple.
Yeah.
Lyra's done.
Mm-hmm. But if she wasn't done before, she decides that she's going to go and find out what is in the secret room that Miss Coulter keeps going back to.
Mm-hmm.
Pantalaimon finds some papers in the trash, and she sees that Mrs. Coulter is part of the General Oblation Board and has some confidential intercision data.
And they make a lot of fuss about G-O-B.
G-O-B.
G-O-B. G-O-B. Like three times they say it. Just in case you didn't get it.
Wait. Wait. Are you saying that that is where they got the word gobbler? G-O-B is the first three letters of gobbler.
Gobbler. Brain explode.
She's the gobbliest gobbler out there. And specifically took Roger and Billy, I think. Well, no, we know she did. Why, it doesn't matter. She shouldn't have, but she did.
Yes.
So while she's distracted, the monkey finds his compass finds the golden compass in her room, and she's able to sneak out before Mrs. Coulter and the monkey can catch her by just jumping out the window with all of her stuff.
It's pretty straightforward.
It is, and more so than it should has any right to be. Like if the monkey, and I keep calling it a monkey, I'm sure it's some sort of technical kind of.
Nah, they just call it a monkey.
Just monkey. Okay, yeah. Good. So if I have to go into like orangutan or chimpanzee.
I just realized they never even give. I don't even think they do this in the books. He doesn't have a name. That's how how much she hates him.
Wild.
Basically.
Rough. Well. Yeah, it finds the compass. It's been reduced to it now. It finds the compass, and it makes me think. It made me think for a moment that Miss Coulter didn't know that it found it.
Mm-hmm.
Like Lyra ran in enough time, snatched it, and jumped out the window, and then Miss Coulter comes in. And she's like, "Ow, my hand!"
Yeah,
but surely they share that information with each other. Also, the monkey never speaks. I just realized.
Yeah,
also.
That too. It's literally the only demon that doesn't speak.
So she runs away down the streets and is chased by these skullcap wearing gobblers, and they are saved by, and I wrote this down, wasn't in the movie, Tony Costa's the archer,
mm-hmm.
Ma Costa's son that saves her from these net throwing gentlemen. And we see in this scene that when a person dies, their demon dissolves into dust.
Mm-hmm.
But maybe the people in the scene don't know that because they don't have a special lens on the camera that we were watching it through.
Yeah. I think my understanding is that what you see when that happens is just, it's the in-game effect. In-game effect.
Yeah, they get snapped.
Avengers effect, yes.
Avengers, yeah. So we see that Ma Costa, Billy's mom, has been following her to make sure that she's safe.
For some reason.
For reasons.
Yeah, not a thing.
But don't worry, we're going to go see Lord Fa, and he's going to explain everything.
He's going to make everything better.
Yep. So they take the steampunk boat to see Lord Fa, who is played by fucking Lord Carson. Did you watch Downton Abbey?
I did not.
Oh my God. What a shock this is to see after watching all these seasons of Downton Abbey. This guy.
Go ahead.
This guy with tattoos on his face and long hair.
I want to talk about that face tattoo though.
Yes,
oh,
let's talk about it.
So bad. So my assumption is it was too shiny when they first put it on. So they covered it with like either concealer or makeup or something, and it's not the same fucking color as the rest of us. They didn't put makeup on the rest of his face.
Nope.
And it's so obvious, and that bothered me so much in that scene.
Yeah, it really did. Like why force the face tattoo?
I don't know. Like, I don't know to make it more
their inherent
exotic.
Differentness was already inherent.
Yeah, you put black eyeliner on the dude, like what else do you want?
Right, you put braids in his long gray hair, like it's just call it a day. But he's doing the thing. And he says that Lord Asriel has tasked the Egyptians with keeping track of her.
Mm-hmm.
And why? Why don't they just let... Why didn't Lord Asriel just leave her in the care of the Egyptians? Because obviously this would be the much better place for her to learn how to read the golden compass, because it's exactly what she does.
Yeah, it's weird. There's like this idea of a scholarly sanctuary or mm-hmm. something in the books, but obviously, you know, they haven't talked about that at all in the movie, so mm-hmm. it's just this thing that happens. Also, it annoys me so much that the Egyptians had to like scoop Lyra up and take her somewhere. It robs her of some of her agency.
Right.
Just one of my biggest complaints about this movie is how much agency is taken from Lyra. And that's the decisions that she makes, the weird paths that she decides to take,
mm-hmm.
is just a huge part of her character. And when you start picking away those parts, it's like, I don't know, she just is kind of getting railroaded through this movie.
Right. That's an excellent point. Because she's not making many of these decisions. She's got, you know, this wit and this veracity to her that
she doesn't get to do much with.
Right,
really,
exactly.
Until, like, toward the end of the book, I guess.
Like, I thought this was a really great Lyra that they cast here.
This was her first acting role.
Oh, really?
Yeah. I think she did a pretty great job.
Yeah, she's just got so much, like, spunk and precociousness to her.
Mm-hmm.
And she looks like a believable hybrid between Daniel Craig and Nicole Kidman, but not something you'd immediately suss out mm-hmm. when you see her. We'll never get more of her.
Nope.
So quickly we go to and why. I'm not sure, because I think it really takes away the tension from what we see later.
Mm-hmm.
But we see children in the north that are writing home to their parents, and they are in Bolvanger, even though we don't know this at the time.
Right. It's the intercision facility.
Yeah. And then we go to Pa Favril, whatever his name is, and Miss Coulter discussing the prophecy of the witches, and that she has a box of golden bees or spy flies to go find Lyra.
I don't know why they felt the need to have, like, why did they spend time on this scene?
Is this in the books that she sends these things?
It is, but I think there would be a lot more dramatic tension if they just showed up on the boat. And then somehow you find out that it was, or you assume
it's
that it was Miss Coulter, because she's the only one fucking chasing Lyra at this point,
exactly.
As far as we know. Yeah. Her or the Magisterium or both.
She's working with the Magisterium.
Yeah. So
why
did you...
So it's either her or Lord Asriel.
Exactly.
And, yeah.
So why did you feel the need to show this little scene? I guess they thought the idea of little steampunk flies would just like blow people's minds, and they needed to be explained. I don't know.
Yeah. It's okay. So when I was making my notes for doing this podcast, I was like, this is way too much exposition, and I cut it in half. Mm-hmm. And then I read it again, and I was like, this is still way too much exposition. I cut it in half again. And I feel like we have what can be the most concise podcast we have on our hands right now. I feel like the scripts could have used that a few times over.
Yeah, absolutely.
Maybe, I don't know. They're... Maybe less makeover montages, maybe cut out some of these like scenes that assume that you're making this movie for an adult to understand, but also below YA can also follow.
Mm-hmm.
I don't know. Who's this movie for?
That's a good question.
Another quick shot of Asriel being taken for the Magisterium by the Samoyeds.
Yeah. In the books, it was the bears that got him.
But, oh, really?
Yeah. I guess they didn't want to pay for that extra CGI.
No,
which they were already, it was already an incredibly bloated budget, so I get it.
Yeah. So Lyra on the boat is attacked by these beesquitos, which we later learn are spy flies. Put a correction in there, but I like the name beesquitos.
It's pretty good. Sounds like a chip of some kind.
Yeah tasty.
Tasty bug chips.
So they capture one of these things in a little tin, and then Serafina Pecola arrives in the number one most bizarre cut of this movie. You see her fade in and start to turn to the left, and then we see Lyra's reaction. You turn back and she's crouching to the right, and they chop this scene up so weirdly. Just let her make an entrance.
Yeah.
Because if anyone needed more screen time in this movie, it was Eva Green.
She did a good job with that character, I feel like.
She did. Yeah. She did the most she could. Aaron and I did Penny Dreadful. Mm-hmm. We covered that for, we did our own podcast about it on Bald Move. And she's a national treasure, I think. And it just really, this is one of the things that bums me out the most, that we didn't get more of her as a clan queen of the witches.
Right, but that is kind of following the books too, though. You really don't get a lot of actual background on any of the witches.
Yeah. I mean, that's fine. I don't need her background. Just two more movies of her. Maybe, oh, you know what? I'm holding out hope that they cast her for the clan witch in this upcoming series. Fingers crossed.
That'd be fun. It seems like they are... with the exception of the one who is supposed to be from Texas, it seems like they are sticking mostly to British actors.
Okay.
Which I'm kind of okay with. I don't know how many more fake English accents I need to hear in my lifetime.
Yeah.
Getting pretty sick of it.
Here's what's new in premium content for our club members.
Executive producers get to exercise their voting fingers again this week with another prestige movie poll. This week's nominees are Mystic River, The Last Samurai, and Secondhand Lions. Take your pick and seal our fate.
This Monday on the Premium feed, we open up the books and deliver a State of the Empire podcast, talking about the current condition of Bald Move and our plans for this year.
This Friday, it's Lunch 420, which given last weekend seems like a tragic missed opportunity. Ah well, lunch will be served piping hot at 1 p.m. Eastern. Come join live or warm up some leftovers when lunch is released in podcast form later that day.
If you want more Bald Move in your life, head over to support.baldmove.com to find out how you can get tons of bonus audio and video content plus ad-free feeds.
Since the dawn of time, we've been putting clothes on our back that identify us with our people, our group, our tribe.
And while Bald Move might be one of the smallest, weirdest tribes out there, transcending all concepts of border, class, culture, and creed, we still have respect for the old ways.
At support.baldmove.com, you can get t-shirts, hats, mugs, and more. We have something for every one of our podcasts, or just wear the four pips of the Bald Move logo with pride.
Bald Move merch beats running around naked, and they make a great gift for the Bald Move fan in your life. Join our tribe! Head over to support.baldmove.com and click on merch to start shopping.
So, Serafina here says that they are taking the kids to Balvanger, mm-hmm. which is news to Lyra, specifically the place, I believe. And then we arrive in Trollisland, where we get to meet, which is an inspired casting choice, Sam Elliott as the aeronaut Lee Scoresby.
Can I tell you, Phil Pullman himself said that this was the one performance that really nailed it in the movie.
Really?
I guess he is the ideal Lee.
He's so
fucking
good.
Which blows my mind. As soon as I saw him on the screen, I didn't watch this. I haven't seen this movie since it was in theaters. And I forgot literally everything about it. As soon as I saw him on the screen, like last night, I had to pause because I was laughing too hard.
I know, so did I. Okay, so I was watching this movie for our notes.
Mm-hmm.
And Aaron sat down and started watching it halfway through with me. And it was about this scene that I just started slapping him. And I was like, is this Sam Elliott? Is this Sam Elliott? And then, like, it just keeps going on from here.
Yeah.
You thought the cast was stacked before.
Mm-hmm.
Wait till you hear that Kathy Bates is exactly one line as Hester the Rabbit, Lee Scoresby's demon.
Excuse me. She has three lines.
Oh, yeah? That's, yeah.
So good. It's funny that you say that because... I had been watching the scene for a few minutes and Jim came up the stairs and he was like, do I hear Sam Elliott? Yes, this is all happening. This is real life. What a get.
Oh, so good.
Like, and his greasy, greasy hair. It's amazing.
That's what I'm saying. Like, this is what I mourn about this movie is that you had these perfect actors.
I had really good talent. It just, the project itself was mismanaged so much.
Speaking of mismanaged talent, we get to meet Yorick Berenson. I can't forget to pronounce the bear in that name.
Berenson.
Who's played by Ian McKellen, of course.
Of course.
We get introduced to the fact that he's a Panzerbjorn, which just literally means armored bear.
Yeah.
And that he was already exiled for like losing a battle, a challenge to his throne.
Mm-hmm.
And that he, when he came to this town to just kind of cool his heels for a bit, but the townspeople got him drunk on whiskey and stole his armor made out of sky iron from falling stars, which shitty.
Yeah, I think it was an interesting choice to sanitize his background a little bit. In the books, he killed a bear, and that's why he was exiled.
He killed a bear?
Yeah, he got in a fight. Okay. He was provoked into a fight with a bear, and for reasons he got too angry and he killed the bear.
So it's like,
and that's like against all bear code. Apparently, is killing another bear.
Okay.
But I guess that was kind of shorthand they had to give. I don't know. Maybe it was more dramatic to think that the Bear King had defeated him before. So, will he defeat him again at the end of the book? Who knows?
Right. The setup to the story was weird because I think they could have gone with a story of he was challenged to the throne and he lost fair and square.
Mm-hmm.
And that he came here to hang out. And that people stole his armor from him. And that's the way that I just explained it, but that's not what happens in the movie. What happens in the movie is that they explain that he came here, he got drunk on whiskey, which is how he gets paid now. His primary form of currency is whiskey. And he got drunk one time and they took all of his armor, but also before that too. And the way that they set up his backstory was bizarre. But anyway, Lyra can quickly help him find his armor, and he goes and he bursts into the armory, built a specific shack that looks like it was built to hold bear armor. But what do I know? I'm not from Charles Lund.
There are like a bunch of Catholic ideograms
yeah.
all over the wall that eventually breaks apart because a bear came through.
Right.
Yeah, so you got some bear damage. I bet you neglected to buy bear insurance.
You didn't get bear insurance.
We're in the north. What are you doing? There's bears just like everywhere.
Yeah, there's a whole lot of them. But
sorry.
No, don't apologize for their lack of bear insurance. He finds his armor. Lee Scoresby shows up and says that this was actually my idea the whole time. I was working on getting you out, buddy, but I found this little girl and she seemed like an easier plan and it worked faster than I thought. So Lyra's got an army now.
Yep, a tiny army.
All right, let's just do a quick evil check-in.
Oh, God.
With the Magisterial Emissary and Fra Pavel.
This starts to feel pretty repetitive. It's like a formula of the way these, you know, check-in scenes happen. And at this point in the movie, I'm like, oh, God, how many more times am I going to have to go through this? I still have an hour? Dear God.
Right.
Yeah.
I get it. You guys are still evil. You still want to poison people. You still want Asriel in jail.
You still want to cut kids apart. Like, I get it.
Exactly. Yep. And then we also see in the evil airship that Mrs. Coulter is longing for Lyra in a way that I think she didn't expect. Okay. We'll talk about that later.
Yeah.
But her own demon knocks Lyra's photo out of her hand and she slaps her demon across the face for it. And then quickly gathers it up and comforts it. So
pretty typical abusive behavior.
What I thought was really interesting here that they didn't explore, maybe they do in the show, is that having your demon soul walk alongside you is a really interesting way to show physical representation of mental illness.
Mm-hmm.
And the way that people say, like, if you have a broken leg, you won't just people don't expect you to just walk on it. You go to the hospital and you get it fixed.
Mm-hmm.
With mental illness, it's something that people can't grasp and see and understand.
Right. It's an invisible disability.
Right. So having a demon alongside you in that way, like, is she having some sort of, is she bipolar in some way?
Mm-hmm.
Well, how does mental illness work in this universe?
These are all good questions. Actually, the first book of the new trilogy goes into that a little bit. There is a very bad dude who has a very bad hyena demon that he just despises and he beats all the time.
Is his name Scar by chance?
No. Okay. I see what you did there. I didn't at first, but then I did, and it was good. I liked it.
Yeah. All questions that this movie will not answer.
Nope.
So Lyra, back at the Egyptian camp, she decides to look at the compass again and notices that it keeps showing her this house by a lake, and finds Yorick, and who's, you know, he's just kind of looking off into the middle distance because that's what he does. He's a thoughtful bear. And this is my favorite scenes in the movie. She's like, I just keep seeing this thing. And it's like, well, you know, I just thought I'd put it out there and give it a chance. And he says, you want me, or you want to ride me? Mm-hmm. And she's like, yeah. And he's like, hell yeah, girl. I just need to take off my armor. We'll go faster and we'll just be off. Like,
we'll blast through snowdrifts. Yeah. It'll be amazing.
Yeah. Yep. Yeah. We're not even going to tell anyone where we're going.
Yep. We're none just going to just peace out.
So they do peace out, and they go to the house, and they find Billy, and his demon has been taken, and he looks like shit.
But as much like shit as he does look, I feel like this was another thing that was sanitized a little bit for the movie, because in the books, he is like, he is a wreck. He is talking, and he actually has like this dry, dead fish that he's like clutching to his chest.
Oh my God.
Because he misses his demon so much.
Course.
And it's fucking heartbreaking. And also he dies, but he doesn't hear. He like gets to meet up with his mom, who wasn't even, she didn't come north.
No.
In the book, but she did here. But just to have this reunion, I guess, to give us like some false idea that there was a happy ending there, but
right, that's so much more than was missing than I thought was missing.
They make it pretty clear that a person can't actually survive without their demon.
Yeah.
Yeah.
Which is the impression I think I was given by how closely they show the relationship between your person and your demon previously. But the only questions I had were like, what the fuck is he doing here in his cold shack where he would clearly have died under a tarp?
Right.
Were there other kids in that shack? Why was he there? Was he like supposed to be ice fishing without a soul? I just don't understand what happens to children after they're demonized.
It's not very clear in the movie, the book. There were a few kids that got out.
Yeah.
I think they actually do discuss that in a later scene once Bullvanger becomes
a
bigger part of the, they're giving a report to
Mrs.
Coulter.
He's one of the three children.
Oh, some of the kids died, but then some of them got out, and she was real mad about it.
Yeah, they said three children got out, two were recovered, but they were dead.
Mm-hmm.
So Billy's the third. Okay, that makes a little bit more sense, but not really.
Yeah, it's
how
weird.
Did he get that far?
Yep.
Also,
it was an actual town in the book. It wasn't just a fucking ice shack in the middle of.
Okay.
The great north nowhere.
They ran out of ice bear budget to render a whole town. So
they didn't want it, yeah.
I get it. So they return Billy to the Costa family, and everything's fine, except for it's not, and the Samoyeds show up. Are they the Samoyeds? Do I keep saying that? Because that's the dog type, and I think it's... Okay, so they're all Timberwolves, and nobody chose a Samoyed as their demon.
So messed up.
Real missed opportunity.
They are called Samoyeds in the movie. Interesting, because if I'm not mistaken, in the book, all of the people who are working for the Magisterium in the north are called Tartars.
Oh.
But here they actually split them into two separate groups. I don't know if that was like a nod toward, hey, indigenous people exist too. But either way, calling them Samoyeds still sucks. Like, that's just... That's a dog thing, and maybe that is a legitimate name for indigenous northern people, but if it is, I haven't heard it.
Right. Like the Egyptian thing. It could have used a little closer look.
Yeah, it was an okay attempt, but it was just an attempt.
Yeah. So, in this ensuing battle, Lyra gets taken to the ice bears.
Yeah, we just... The order of events is completely switched around in the movie. Yeah, in the book, they go to Bullvanger first.
Oh,
and
okay.
it, the like semi-climax is the fight between the bears.
Oh.
And then it goes on to the other part that you don't get to know about because it wasn't in the movie. Okay. So read the book, you ding dong.
Yeah, or I'll wait for the sequel. Thank you. So she gets taken to Ice Bears, and the first thing I notice is that Yorick's armor as the rightful prince isn't nearly as cool as Ragnar's super cool armor with his like spiky helmet.
They do, yeah, they do a poor job representing this, shockingly, in the movie. But the Magisterium has been investing in the Ice Bears, basically paid them.
Oh my god, are you serious?
Yeah, and that's
that makes
why
so much more sense.
I know, right? It's all like it's an explanation for why things are the way they are.
Okay, yep, yep.
But that would have been a great explanation. That's why his armor is like choice, you know, and Yorick's is rusted and pitted and
but Yorick's
terrible.
Was described as being made out of sky iron from falling stars.
Meteorite,
it should be
yeah.
a thousand times cooler. Is this not his original armor? Is it his original armor?
It's his original armor. In the book, they give him a little scene after he gets it back where he goes to the shore of the lake or the ocean or whatever and takes some, he kills a seal and he takes the fat from the seal and like rubs yeah. it on the armor and polishes it back up again.
Yeah.
But it's still described, like the quality of it is not as good as it's Yofur. But they didn't want to call him Yofur.
Yeah.
Because it was too close to Yorick, I guess. So they called him Ragnar instead.
Oh, okay.
But still, what you make yourself out of a meteorite is never going to be as good as what religious people can
never
buy you.
Fact. Yeah. Fact.
No gold inlay in meteorite armor when you're just making it with hammers and stuff.
Yeah. So Ragnar desperately wants a demon, which we already know, or Lyra already knows.
Mm-hmm.
So she is the gifted storyteller that she is, says that she is Yorick's demon and that she actually wants to be Ragnar's demon. You know how that goes with the whole classic switcheroo. He's the rightful king and she wants to be his demon.
Mm-hmm.
And he's doing that. He's doing that cool thing that you mentioned earlier, like clutching his would-be demon.
Yeah.
That shows the impetus in his mind. So he asks her to prove how she's a demon. She uses the golden compass to figure out how he actually got to be the king that he is, and that is he poisoned it's a classic poison the old king and cast out the new one so that you are the last in line of succession. Killing the old king doesn't seem necessary. Weakening the new king that you took over probably would have explained more. Like, if you poison the old king, fine, I guess.
Mm-hmm.
But him challenging Yorick for the throne makes me think that maybe Yorick just lost fair and square. The Magisterium didn't give them new armor before that.
Right. This is how it went down in the books.
Okay.
I got the dirty details.
Give me the scoop.
So he actually, Ragnar asks Lyra a different question. He asks her, what was the first creature I killed?
Mm.
And it was his own father.
Ah!
So he's also a bear killer, so he's also a piece of shit. Which, fine, whatever.
Go with that!
Yeah. But also, because... Also, the way that Yorick was exiled in the book is what led to Yofur being able to take over, because he was the only other one who had a claim to the throne.
Okay.
But because Yorick was exiled, you know, obviously he couldn't do that anymore. So Yofur was just the natural, like, there's nobody else, so it's you kind of thing.
Yeah. Huh.
Yeah, it's... they changed things in such a weird way there.
Yeah, I mean, every time I'm disappointed by this, by what I've seen in this movie, I also get excited because I feel like HBO knows what went wrong and how they're going to fix it.
I really hope so.
Instead of two very dense hours, they're going to give us however many hours.
That's the other thing. I'm really looking forward to the runtime because I think a lot of what made this fail so bad is there's just so much to explain in 2 hours, but now you get 10 hours to really get in depth with character development and actual explanations and slowly releasing information over time instead of dumping it in enormous 5-minute chunks.
Right. And the world building and the lore, that's something that I'm really interested in. And it's something that I'm all about. I don't want you to yada yada through that stuff. Yeah. Like, put me there.
Right. Show me, don't tell me.
Yeah. Mm-hmm. So, Yorick shows back up to the Ice Bears. And he's got his armor on, and he's ready to challenge Ragnar again. And before he can, renames her Lyra Silvertongue.
Yep.
Which, that's cool. I like that.
It is cool. You can do a lot worse than getting a new name from a bear.
Yeah.
I like it.
Especially since I tried to do some mental gymnastics about what her last name really meant or was.
Mm-hmm.
Was it spelling some other word backwards? Nope, just Balakwa is a name. Just is what cool, I take away from this movie.
Just a cool French name.
Yeah.
I don't even know where Balakwa comes from.
No.
Because Coulter. What is Azrael's last name? I don't even know. Is it Balakwa?
Is it just Azrael?
He's Lord Azrael. I can't remember if they ever...
First name was something else.
Give him a surname. That's probably a little detail that I've forgotten. I have read so many of these books in the last few weeks.
So Ragnar and Yorick have this battle for the kingdom. Mm-hmm. And right when Ragnar bites Yorick's arm, I'm thinking, oh my God, really? They're not going to show us any blood?
Like, yeah, it's just again, very sanitized.
Exactly. Yeah. But then he rips his fucking jaw off.
Yes.
And the most sanitized jaw ripping I've ever seen.
A very tasteful, jaw ripping. I would say, yes.
And he says, all right, you fuckers, who's the king again? And they're like, oh, yeah, you are. Do you want some new armor? And he's like, no, fuck it. And he leaves behind all of his armor and he barebacks.
Oh, he eats Yofur's heart in the book.
Oh.
I know, so much cooler. Much more like heavy metal.
So instead of any of those cool things, he barebacks Lyra to Bullvanger himself, and they get to this ice bridge, and he's like, oh, I'm right behind you. It's fine. You just go ahead. I'll be right behind you.
I don't weigh multiple hundreds of thousands of pounds. Yeah, no.
Right, like I think he knew in his heart that he barely trusted her weight getting across there.
Mm-hmm.
But she made it, and he's like, all right, I'll just stay right there. I'll come back for you. And she's like, no, I'm going to go in. So
it's such a stupid thing that they had to manufacture because of the order that they did things in.
Right.
Yeah.
Because I'm going to spoil these later scenes here for you, but he goes from here back to his home, where presumably his ice bear home, where he's the king of,
mm-hmm.
and he left his armor,
mm-hmm.
and gets only his armor and comes back to help with this final fight.
Yeah.
Not the rest of the ice bears that just pledge their allegiance to him. Just him.
It makes no sense at all.
Okay. So Lyra goes to Bullfinger, finds Roger as Lizzie Brooks,
mm-hmm.
Which doesn't matter for very long that she made up some sort of identity, because Miss Coulter arrives, and this is where you talked about earlier, we find out that three children have escaped, two dead, one is living. And right after she leaves, Lizzie Brooks gets captured, and they immediately just throw her into the intercision machine.
Yeah, they were just talking about how like Mrs. Coulter was a terrible person because she took some kind of glee out of, like, she was so
ripping their souls away from them.
Exactly, and then they're just going to turn around and do the same thing. Huh. Weird. It's almost like it's bad writing.
Like, is this protocol? If a child overhears too much, it's protocol to just throw them in there?
Maybe.
And also, they're all wearing scrubs and what seem to be uniforms, mm-hmm. so there's no procedure leading up to this? You don't, like, take all of her... You don't look through her bags or her pockets to make sure there's not some stuff in there that's going to be messed with in the intercision machine?
Oh, she's just a kid. What would she have that would...
Yeah. I mean, it didn't end up mattering. It just seems like it just seemed way too convenient of a way to dispose of a child.
Mm-hmm.
When you could just lock them in a room by themselves and say, what do we do?
Right.
Thankfully, Mrs. Coulter arrives because I would say... 85% of the procedure is just for show.
Mm-hmm.
It's the last 15% she saved her from.
Right.
yeah, that math checks out. So
I would say her only mom moment in the entire movie.
Right.
Yeah.
Yeah. She stops her from happening. And then she wakes up. Lyra wakes up with Pan right beside her, which is super cute.
Yeah. He's in his kitty cat form.
Yeah. I love that form. Because when they were going into the lake by the house by the lake earlier, mm-hmm. and Pan was saying, I want to call him Pants for some reason. Pan's a lineman, was really scared. He's like, don't go in there. Don't go in there. He had these big, like, cute cat eyes. Yep. It killed me. So he's doing it again. He's being adorable. And this scene causes Mrs. Coulter to reveal that she, in a roundabout way, that she and Lord Asriel are her real mother and father.
Mm-hmm.
So Lyra gives her the gold spy fly that they had encased in this metal pan. And this thing comes out with such a force that it knocks out Miss Coulter, which couldn't have asked for a better result in this whole trickery thing. I thought her trying to force it open would be the time she needed to buy to escape.
Yeah.
But it was what happened after. No, no.
Well, it was established before that the flies have like a neurotoxin that puts you to sleep.
Oh.
They can sting you. Yeah.
Was it?
Also, yeah. We skipped over this point earlier. We found out in that discussion after Mrs. Coulter saves Lyra that dust is supposedly the byproduct of original sin.
Oh, okay. Yeah, I did completely miss that.
Yeah, I think she just straight up told Lyra that. I think that is happening in the, because then
there's,
it says
there's so
and
much
who
direct
Lyra's awful parents are.
Exposition to miss.
Yeah.
So what? So how does that work?
So what Mrs. Coulter says to Lyra is, our ancestors, two of our ancestors a long time ago, which they don't straight up say it, but it's Adam and Eve, obviously, made a terrible mistake, and that caused dust to exist. And when dust starts settling on people, that's bad, apparently, because it came from original sin. And that's what happens whenever people, when their demons settle their shape. When they settle their shape, more dust can enter a person through their demon.
Oh.
And that's bad. And they don't really say why that's bad, other than the fact that it is tied to this idea of original sin.
I guess,
and they don't say why, like, how they know that happened, that caused dust. Like, how do you know, lady? You weren't there. You didn't have a filter on your camera. Cameras didn't exist back then. Oh, I caught you in your lie.
That's what's so confusing about it, is that dust, it's a shiny thing that makes you want to be in favor of it.
Generally? And I think it might have something to do with like sexual desire.
What?
Puberty. Sexual desire like tied in somehow in this.
So you want less dust
series?
Or more dust?
Less dust.
You want the dust to be moving more?
You don't want any. You don't want it to be connected to you anymore.
Okay, I'm very
confused. And
that's
why they're cutting the demons off of kids before their demons can settle.
Huh.
Is to save them from dust settling on them and causing them to have like sexual thoughts and growing up, basically.
Oh, okay.
Yeah.
I'm still confused. We'll get to it in the main His Dark Material series. Don't worry.
I'm sure it'll handle it 1,000 times better than this did. It won't be two lines of dialogue. It'll be, you know, discuss over the course of 10 episodes or 30 episodes.
Yeah.
Yeah.
Whatever it is. Okay, so Lyra, in her escape, destroys the lab in an awesome way, and all these pre-prepared, warmly dressed children escape, only to be stopped by the Samoyeds, who are only stopped by Scoresby, the only one Panzerbjorn. I wrote down the Panzerbjorn, but there was just one. The Egyptians and the witches showed up.
When the Egyptians and Lyra were first setting off from Trollisland?
From the camp that they set up to the house by the lake.
Okay, yeah,
we saw
a flock of witches. That's the only way to describe them, because that's what they look like. It's just ravens crossing the sky. And Yorick says,
I'd hate to be on the other side of that battle.
Yeah, you better hope that they're flying to help you. Otherwise, you're fucked. He doesn't say that, but he admits no, it.
It's implied. The one bit of exposition, direct exposition we didn't get, you're fucked. But yeah, the witches, God, they were traveling so fast. It's almost as if they could have prevented any of the other bad things that happened because they just showed up now.
And they have like a lot of foreknowledge, apparently.
Right. They know about all these prophecies and things.
Oh, you know what? I forgot. I should have mentioned this up top. And the movie should have mentioned this up top, too. So this whole prophecy around Lyra, she is not supposed to know that she is doing... She's not supposed to know her ultimate goal in this prophecy. Like, it'll only happen if she doesn't know what she's doing.
Right.
Which basically means she has to, like, fall on her dick a whole bunch and cause things to happen.
Yeah. As you do when you're a kid.
So, like, I guess you could maybe say that's why the witches don't interfere that much up until a certain point, but
yeah,
still stinks of bullshit to me.
I agree. The other thing that stinks of bullshit is whatever the fuck they're doing with the witches in this fighting scene.
What? Serafina's bow is made of knives, apparently, because she's just like, she's killing people just by hitting them with the bottom part of the bow in the head. That's all it takes.
Yeah, just in the...
These soldiers.
And it's happening like fast and so disjointedly that this could have been a really cool fight scene, but it's small and weirdly edited. So,
and it's all one color except for the gold dust.
Right.
Yeah.
There's a huge lack of armored ice bears.
It just wasn't very dramatic.
I was under the impression that war was the sea that they swam in.
Yeah.
But not.
So why wouldn't they be all up in this? Oh, right. Because the order of the fucking thing was changed.
Right.
That's why. Ugh. And also they probably didn't want to pay for that. But yeah, it was like to have all these different diverse groups of people fighting. It was weirdly like non-dramatic and kind of anticlimactic.
Right. Like, okay. I am a huge Lord of the Rings fan. So if we could have gotten a shot of a witch. Oh my God, what if Serafina and Tony Costa had like conjoined their armor or their archer powers and done something cool with that in a fight scene?
Mm-hmm.
Like get fucking Michelle McLaren in there and done.
And this is the studio that made the Lord of the Rings movies.
Yes!
What the fuck?
What the fuck?
What the actual fuck?
You're telling me one of the 3,000 famous people that are not even just that guy type of famous people, like people that are immediately recognizable by their voice? None of them knew someone who could help you with the fight scene.
Right. Agreed.
None of the 100 extra million dollars in China could have helped you out with this.
To be fair, 100 of those extra million dollars probably went to script rewrites.
Okay.
Because it happened so many times.
Well, let's hope so. This is the best they could do. Okay, so let's get this over with.
Okay, sorry.
No, I mean, this movie, it needs to end now.
That's true.
Lee Scoresby and Serafina, which is cool. I would pay the number of dollars I would pay for some Lee Scoresby, specifically Sam Elliott and Eva Green as Serafina Palaka fanfic.
Yeah.
Is not zero.
Reasonable.
I love this.
Yeah, those are two very interesting people to throw into a room together.
Yeah.
Yeah.
So you never watched Penny Dreadful?
I did not. I started watching part of it, I think, and then I stopped because it was getting a little soap opera-y for me.
It's good. It's really good. She's got the same kind of... Okay, so the reason I'm saying that, I guess, if I want to get into my psychology of it, so Eva Green's character in the show has a relationship that's not sexual at all, but is not like a father-daughter thing either. It's just kind of a professional relationship with two like incredibly hot people. And I've been buying a lot of time by talking, trying to figure out what this guy's name is, but I can't remember.
Oh no.
He was one of the Bonds. Timothy something.
When I hear Timothy, I immediately want to say Oliphant. That is very wrong.
I know. That's what keeps coming to my mind too. But her and this other guy in Penny Dreadful, they're really good. And it's reminiscent of that. And it just makes me miss that. And let's let Lyra speak for us here. Scoresby and Serafina are talking about the prophecy that Lyra will decide the war which is to come, which would have been a good time for them to say, but she's also not supposed to know, mm-hmm. like you did, but they didn't. And that Azrael is trying to travel, or Lord Azrael is trying to travel between worlds to study this dust.
Yeah, which is an interesting motivation to assign to that. I wouldn't say if that is true.
Okay.
But sure. He's... They really...
This is our and the audience and their understanding of it?
Yeah, it's interesting. They really had to up his charisma by like 10 times to make him play on this particular screen in this particular movie. Because actually, he's an enormous piece of shit.
What?
But you never see that.
Her dad, her mom and dad suck?
Yeah, they're terrible. Which God, we could go into the role of bad parents in making YA happen.
Yeah.
Like enabling YA to happen, but
we could talk about the role of bad parents and why YA works on us. Let's not do that today.
Just in general, like I don't think you ever see good parents in YA because bad parents are a lot
Make
of the
good
time
stories.
What leads their children to, you know, try to find another world or run off with whatever. But anyway, I digress.
This is the digression podcast.
So there's a line that Lyra has, and I don't know if it's the last line, but it's one of the last ones that she has. And she says, in reference to Azrael, "I'm bringing him what he needs."
Yeah,
and
I had that written down.
Is deeply ominous if you know the ending of the book.
I don't.
I will not say, but I will say that what happens from that is one of the reasons why I say Azrael is just as big a piece of shit as anybody in the Magisterium, as Mrs. Coulter, as anybody. Like, science and religion are both equally bad and kind of running amok.
Right, in the wrong hands.
Yeah, but it's in the books, religion and science are kind of bad. But in this movie, it's religion is the only thing that's bad.
Yeah. I think in the real world, that can be true too. You know, if you think about like Nazi doctors and the kind of
anybody with power and authority and ambition,
right,
that is unchecked,
right, there's got to be some.
And this movie shies away from that. It's one of the many things, one of my overall impressions of this movie is that it is afraid to go into that kind of theme. Yeah, so in general this movie is afraid to explore the darker themes in the books. There is the idea of the destruction of imagination, which
could be interesting because they set up that Lyra has this incredible imagination.
Yeah, exactly. So that is probably why Mrs. Coulter saved her from the intercision machine, even though she is putting other kids through it.
So that's going to be important.
Yeah, because she thinks that Lyra is better than those other kids.
Oh.
So it's only certain kinds of kids who deserve to have their...
But she must think that about herself, too, because she's not willing to... cut her demon away from her, or it's too late.
I think it might be too late. I think they mentioned that in the book, but again, the movie doesn't have time to give us even more exposition.
Yeah, so, you know, Lyra's last question here, my last notes are that she wants to know what dust is, and you know what? Honestly, so do I.
Yeah.
I don't have any better understandings from this movie. You know, if I hadn't have... tried to read through the book before we did this podcast, which honestly I was saving doing all of my like reading and research and stuff until after this movie, because when I started watching this movie and doing the two things simultaneously, I realized that I'm gonna just gonna take this one at a time.
It's a lot,
and I'm glad I did, because it's got to be so confusing for anyone who had no exposure to this universe at all.
If you don't come into this movie already having at least a layman's knowledge of the series, it's a lot. It's so much to take in, and they don't do a good job with it.
Right. There's simultaneously too much exposition and not enough in the right places.
Exactly.
Like they're missing... They should have figured out the themes first before they tried to force us into a screenplay.
That is a very good point. It feels like the people who wrote this movie, or the composite people who wrote this movie, maybe didn't understand what it was about.
Right.
Yeah.
They're just like, oh, well, these are cool, flashy characters, so let's get them all committed.
Exactly. These are the events that happened, so here are these events. It was a really ambitious project. Mm-hmm. I'm glad that they did at least try. You always got to give people props for that.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, nobody phoned this in. All these performances are great.
They tried really hard. Mm-hmm. Absolutely. Ultimately, either due to a bad script or just the mismanagement of the project in general by New Line, I don't think it was successful.
Hmm.
But I will say, having watched this movie again, I am that much more excited for the series. Absolutely. I can't wait.
Yeah, me too. I didn't know how excited I would be until watching this terrible movie that just left you with this hunger more than anything.
Absolutely.
I mean, I guess it's a lot better than them making you feel like, so turned off from the franchise. And you're like, no.
Mm-hmm.
But there, you know, there's just some slight differences that you can already know from the trailers. They went back on like Nicole Kidman as this golden blonde that kind of matched her monkey's fur. And just her eyes, she's doing a lot with that. But this like new actress whose name I forget that they cast, who matches Lyra's description in the books of this like dark haired mm-hmm. person, it seems like she's got the same intense energy to her. And I'm really excited for them to expound on this universe and fill in the lore for the love of God, figure out already for the love of. Is there a God figure in the Magisterium?
Mm-hmm. The creator. Yeah.
Okay. For the love of the creator, can you just give us what we want? You know, you have to understand that fans want the lore, the backstory. They mm-hmm. want all of these questions answered or not answered, but acknowledge that they exist and build this world that we all want to be a part of and don't just try to flash it up.
So, yeah. Exactly. It can't just be a series of events strung together. It needs to be an entire being. It can't just be the body. It needs the soul, too.
Yeah.
Just like children. Just like adults.
Yeah. So this new series seems really promising. It's got an incredible cast. Again, like I said, this show starts in America. It will be airing on Monday nights on HBO. And again, our coverage will be weekly, and it'll come out on Wednesdays during the day at some point. And it will be on this Bald Move TV feed. And if you are going to be watching with us and you want to send any feedback to us, then you can do so at tv@baldmove.com. You can also join the forums at forums.baldmove.com to join any of your fellow fans to talk about the episode or discussion. We're excited about this. Obviously, we're taking on this project independent of the boys.
Yep. This continuing through like mid-January project.
Yeah.
Oops, didn't realize that, but that's fine.
So just don't tell them that this is happening, and we'll just keep it between us.
And yeah, they're not in the studio right now, and they will not be. So
exactly. So just open your golden compass, and then you can see when the next episode is going to be posted.
What symbols would that be?
I don't remember any of the symbols. Okay, it would be an alcohol bottle.
Okay, yeah, accurate.
And then morning time. It's got to be like some sort of like a early sun, or what do you
think?
So
it would be the clock, but it would be the topmost meaning of clock, which would be earlier.
Yeah.
I'm such a...
The time that doesn't register like on their schedules.
Exactly.
And then...
And the third hand would be...
A tampon?
I don't remember that, but you may have been watching more closely than me.
Oh, no, I'm talking about the Golden Compass and like how you find a women's podcast on Bald Move TV. And it's like, it's there, right? I mean, it'll point you in the right direction. You'll get there. You know how to read your own alethiometer, so.
They're all different, right? Or something.
But that's all we've got for today. We're so excited to see you guys on November 6th in November. We'll be here. Again, I'm your host, Cecily.
I'm your co-host, Alexis.
And we'll see you soon.
Bye.
Bye.